So our reading in Lamentations tonight, there's a shift that has happened. I think it happens actually a little bit earlier in chapter 3, but it's most obvious here. Because up until this point, our narrator, our lamenter, I still am not sure what to call him, has focused mainly on himself. And sometimes that kind of bordered onto the ridiculous, where he was saying, no one's ever had this much pain or something like that, which, of course, we just know is not true. Occasionally, he'll grieve or lament about his people, but it's mainly about his experiences. And as we saw last week, there's real power in being able to actually name that pain. And say what it actually is, instead of the histrionics and the craziness where he's just making noise. Things seemed a little quieter. He named what he experienced and brought it before God. Well, in our reading today, something is different. He uses the word "we" a lot. In other words, it's not the first person singular, it's the first person plural. He is lamenting with his people. Now, our culture is very individualistic, and there are good things about that, and there are some major pitfalls that we need to be aware of. Their culture was pretty much the opposite. And yet here, he, in this shift, he's now lamenting with and on behalf of his people instead of talking about what he's experienced. And there's real wisdom in that. And it doesn't actually matter what you are grieving. Almost certainly, when you grieve, other people are affected. Almost certainly, if you've experienced loss or a scary diagnosis or definitely a relationship falling apart or a job loss or something like that, the things that we would usually associate with grief, more than one person is involved. It can be very easy to fall into the pit of despair and only see yourself. And so on the one hand, it's just good advice to always remember, more people are affected than just me or you in almost every case. I've been trying to think of a counterexample to that, and I can't. Maybe when Stalin or Hitler died, I don't know. There's probably somebody who was sad, and they're wrong, but whatever. That's a different thing. And I think it's best understood, or it's easiest, I cannot talk tonight, it's easiest to see in terms of, say, a loss. You lose somebody who is very, very important and dear to you that you love very much. Well, of course, you are affected. But if that loss happened in the context of a family, so is all of your family. If it happened in the context of a friend group or a church community or something like that, it affects everybody else to varying degrees. Even a diagnosis, a scary diagnosis, will affect a whole bunch of people. It will affect you, of course, but there will be others who will have to shoulder some of that, and their lives will be impacted as well. And that is all part of grief. And so the wisdom of tonight's reading is that, first off, it functions as a reminder that you don't grieve alone in almost every case, because we're humans. We live in community. And so we grieve in community. Notice he's, and we'll come back to that thought in a little bit. Notice he's also the narrator seems a lot more free to just name the fact that this came on us and we deserved it. Now, please don't hear me say that all grief you experience is deserved, because that's very often not the case. But he seems more able to take responsibility. And that hopefully isn't a surprise to him or anybody else. They had many generations of prophets warning that this was coming. It was no surprise. The language, though, that he uses really catches me in verse 44. And I think it highlights a tension that grief can create. Where he says, "You have covered yourself," he's talking to God, "you have covered yourself with a cloud so that no prayer can get through." This is poetry. Do not read this literally, like clouds somehow prevent prayers or something like that, or prayers can't penetrate cloud. That's, of course, nonsense. But at the same time, we all know what that feels like. In our dark moments and in prayer, to saying, "God, are you even there? Do you even hear this? Do you even care?" That's honest prayer. And the tension that grief creates is that he can say this, that even my prayers can't penetrate because there's a metaphorical cloud of some kind. And then in chapter 5, he says, "Lord, remember what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace." He's talking to God. I'm pretty sure that's prayer. So, which is it? Our prayers will not rise up to God, or, "Lord, remember us," as he speaks directly to God? They're both true. The point isn't to read this as literally as we can, as though that were a game. The point is to express grief. And the tension that his particular grief has created is one where one thing feels to be true, that reaching out to God is a fruitless and pointless endeavor. And at the same time, he can't help but reach out to his Creator, and ideally his Redeemer, given enough time. That's grief. Lament is the process of bringing that up to the surface rather than trying to pretend it doesn't exist, because it will come out. But if it is not brought to the surface by you, it will come out in some very scary ways. Now, nevertheless, he is explaining, as he's lamenting what has happened to his people, he's also demonstrating what it looks like to grieve in community. And grief happens in community. If what I said earlier was true, and I think it is, that you've never experienced a loss or a source of grief that is just you alone, because it impacts others around you, because, again, you're human, as far as I know. That's supposed to be funny, but whatever. I've got to ease the tension at some point. Now, just to get very, very practical for a moment, because this is something, as a pastor, I've seen handled poorly and occasionally well, and just as somebody who's chronically ill, I've seen it handled poorly and also well. Think about grief as beginning in a point. There's usually, if it's a diagnosis, a job loss, a fracture in a relationship, somebody has passed away, kind of just name it. It doesn't matter. Usually there's that innermost point of the people most directly affected. So thinking like a family, they lose somebody. Well, that innermost circle of family are the ones at the very center of that grief. And then imagine everyone else connected to that point of grief through different relationships, either maybe more distant relatives or close family or close friends rather, or neighbor, next door neighbors for the last 30 years, or people that you work with, or church community. Each of those different distances from that center point of grief, imagine them as concentric circles, so larger circles with the same point in the middle. If you're way out here, it means that you are connected to that grief, and maybe you experience it to some extent, but it's not nearly as acute or painful as those who are right in the center. The expression of grief and lament as a not quite hard and fast rule, but 99.9% of the time, that expression of grief should travel outward, not inward. In other words, say your friend has lost an immediate family member, and you knew that family member, and you miss them, and that hurts. Do not go to the widow and unload on them. In different circumstances, I have experienced that, and it is not fun. In other words, do not rely on them for support. You're further out in the circle. Your job is to send support inward. And everyone else's job is to send grief outward. That makes sense. It's just a, I don't know if it's a hobby horse or a soapbox, and I've kind of lost my sense of analogy by saying that, but whatever. That said, grief happens in community. And there are ways that communities can grieve. I'm thinking of, even over the last couple of years, we've had funerals for people that were part of our community that meant a lot to this community. And what is a funeral if it isn't collective communal lamentation? Holding the tension. And remember, at the start of this series, I said there's a lot of tensions here in grief. But holding the tension of being grateful for that person and grateful for what Jesus has done in their lives and through them, and being angry and sad that they're gone. Both are true. And when a community comes together to do that well, it's really a beautiful thing. It's kind of what makes us human. One of the things that our narrator does here that I think is really, really worth considering, especially because he is speaking communally and we as modern Western Americans tend to think in more individualistic terms, is to remind us that the pain that you feel and the ways that you lament matter, and that even if you are convinced you are alone in that grief, you're probably not. And not just because we believe and confess, and we do, that God is with us, but also because there are others affected. And if there are others affected, that means that there are also others that care. One of the true gifts and values of living in community, like, for example, a church, which the Western world has for a very long time and then is slowly starting to forget to our massive detriment, is that when you have a community, you have a medium through which you can grieve. You also have a medium through which you can celebrate and support each other and so on and so forth. But that's for for another time. We're supposed to just talk about lamenting tonight, I guess. Now, this is all good advice, but it's part of Lent, and so I would be remiss if we didn't at least find our way to the final days of Jesus' life. If you go back and read through the final week of Jesus' life in the Gospels, you'll see that most of the hard parts, the grief parts, happen with more than one person. And I've only been able to come up with a couple of examples where somebody is actually alone. If you have a counterexample, let me know. But the first is Jesus in Gethsemane, as he's praying, just pouring his heart out before God, asking him to take the cup of suffering away from him. The answer, of course, is no. But at that moment, Jesus is alone because his friends can't stay awake. That's doubly tragic. I suspect also, I can't prove it, but I suspect that Peter, when he denied that he knew Jesus three times, in spite of his boasting that he would never, I suspect he went off and was alone for a time. He didn't stay that way, but I strongly suspect it. The only other person I could come up with who was ever really alone, potentially, was Thomas, the twin. And I only suspect that because he's not with the disciples when Jesus appears to them for the first time and seems indignant and hurt when his friends, his brothers, tell him that they've seen Jesus. Other than that, as best I can tell, everything happens in a community. Even the two disciples, Clopas and almost certainly his wife, as they are walking in their tragedy and their grief to Emmaus, even there, they at least have each other. And then when they realize what happened, what do? They run and go back to their community. I'm not saying that the story of Jesus' execution is prescriptive. It's not giving us an outline of the way to do things. But instead, it's telling a story that shows us who we actually are. Each of those moments where somebody goes off alone, or at least it seems like they are alone, it indicates that something's gone wrong. And if being alone indicates something has gone wrong, even though we are talking about immense grief, the grief that happens among a community is in a weird way when something goes right. And so in our second to last meditation on what it means to lament, after we've talked about naming pain directly, the difference between just making noise and actually expressing grief, ways to think about God's absence and God's presence at the same time, experienced at the same time in tension, naming responsibility, and that is chapter 3. If chapter 3 is nothing else, it is taking responsibility for our own grief and acknowledging the presence of God even when it doesn't make sense. Then today's meditation is that grief never happens alone, but it's a very effective lie if you are convinced that you are alone. That's when grief can consume. That's when a voice that laments gets silenced. And that's where people go to die. But as we see Jesus going to his public torture and execution. We see the beauty of the community and the relationships that he spent his career building. We see the men terrified and hiding together, except for Thomas. We see the women going back and forth together, plural. We see a man and his wife traveling to Emmaus together and discussing and lamenting their hopes for who this Jesus was supposed to be. That's the product of somebody that knows how to build community. And therefore, that's the product of what happens when grief is lamented together. I really wish I could have been there when they learned that their grief was misplaced. But for now, we stay in the grief and we'll celebrate on April 5th. As you are able, please rise.